Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Anne Burney, an independent scholar of American Studies, and a member of Ride Into History, an historical performance troupe that has toured throughout the United States. Dr. Burney's presentation will be titled Amelia Earhart, First Lady of the Air. It will be given in the persona of the famous early 20th century pioneer and aviatrix. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 14, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Abby Jung, Curator of Education at the Durham Museum.
Today, we are going to do some time traveling. So we are going to see a play, a performance that's going to take us back 80 years before computers, before fast food, before Nintendo and MP3 players, at which point the kids in the office audience are panicking. We are going all the way back to the year 1937. So our speaker today in 1937 is one of the world's most famous pilots. Amelia Earhart is best known as the first woman and the second person to fly solo all by herself across the Atlantic Ocean. Miss Earhart set her first aviation record in the year 1922, so about 15 years ago, flying to an altitude of 14,000 feet. 2 years ago, in 1935, she became the first person to fly solo over the Pacific when she flew from Hawaii to California. On top of that, Miss Amelia Earhart was a founding member and the first president of the 99th International Organization of Women Pilots. She's received Francis Cross of Legion of Honor, the National Geographic Society's Special Gold Medal, and the Distinguished Flying Cross. She's worked as a social worker, an aeronautical advisor, and a career counselor for Purdue University. She's published 2 books, and she's going to write a 3rd book after her upcoming flight around the world, where she's going to travel at the equator. And lucky for us, after Miss Earhart speaks tonight, she's offered to take some questions. So please do have some questions in mind. To tell you the truth, though, I'm actually kind of stalling a little bit because I thought she was here, but I haven't seen her. I thought I heard a plane fly overhead. Did anybody hear? I really hope she's not lost. Has anybody seen her? Oh, thank you for coming.
Hello. Well, I am Amelia Earhart, and it is April 14th, 1937. And we are in Omaha, so I am at the right place at the right time, am I not? A little late, a little late. But, I'm sure that you know this is a very unsettled time for me, so I might as well talk about that right off the bat. Because I know that you have been listening to the radio and reading the newspapers, and you know that I was attempting to fly around the world at the equator. I made it from California to Hawaii, and taking off from Luke Airfield. Well, if you're going to take off from an island, you want to get a good start, right? And I had both propellers going strong, taxiing down the runway, and just as I was ready to lift off, it felt as though a tire blew. The plane started going to the right. I attempted to correct it, and it ground looped to the left. The undercarriage, both propellers, and one wing of my beautiful silver flying laboratory were completely destroyed, and we had to take the Electra back to the Lockheed plant. And I will tell you, there is nothing that a plane hates worse than to be taken someplace by boat. But that's what happened to mine. That's what happened to mine, and I am here in part to assure you that as soon as my plane is repaired, we are going to take off again. But this time, instead of going west, we'll go east. So we'll start from California, of course, and go to Miami and Puerto Rico and South America and across to Africa and India. My itinerary says that I am in India today. But if I'm not going to be flying around the world, this is a fine place to be. Australia, New Guinea, Howland Island, and then Hawaii will be the last stop before we get back to the States instead of the first. And hopefully we'll have better luck with that arrangement. And in the meantime, well, no one pays me to fly aeroplanes. They pay me to talk about flying and write about flying. And I do have those repairs to pay for. So I'm doing a lot of talking. And this is a little by way of apology, because, of course, as a professional speaker, I usually dress properly when I am giving a speech. But you're getting not only aviator's garb, but rather grubby aviator's garb at that. And I want you to know that it's not out of any disrespect. It's just that my proper clothes and I both thought that I would be in India today, and we haven't caught up with each other just yet. And there is this matter. Omaha is not so far away from Atchison, which is where I spent most of my growing up years. And I've been a little nervous about coming back to this area, because the last time I was in Atchison was 2 years ago, and it was for the Kansas Editors Association convention. And it was a great honor to be asked to address the editors in Memorial Hall, and I wore a proper gown. But I learned after the convention that a young reporter had asked Mr. William Allen White — some of you might be familiar with him, if not as the editor of the Emporia Gazette, but as the writer of novels or the politician, or at any rate, the young reporter asked Mr. White what he might like to say to me if he had the opportunity to meet me. And the sage of the plains replied that he would advise me to take a comb into the cockpit with me and use it before I came out. So I've been a little nervous, fearing an encounter with well-coiffed audiences, each member waving a comb at me. But that hasn't happened, and it is a pleasure to be back in my old neighborhood. I thought what I would do is, since I am so informal this evening, is just answer the questions that I get asked the most. How did I get my start in flying? My first flight? My flights across the Atlantic, and then give you a chance to ask me anything else that's on your mind. Is that fair enough? All right. I like to say that my first flight was in Atchison, because, well, that's where I spent, as I said, most of my growing up years. My younger sister and I, we lived with our grandparents during the school year, and they were in Atchison. Our parents had a fine house for us in Kansas City, but Father worked for the railroad, and he was gone a great deal. And our grandmother thought it was a good thing to have her granddaughters in Atchison with her. So we had this really nice childhood. We did. From my bedroom window in the second story, we could look out and we could see the Missouri River as it went past. We made up stories about where it might take us when we grew up. We had the caves in the bank of the river to explore, and we had cousins to play with. It was a wonderful childhood. However, we were living with grandparents. And grandmother could not help it. The 1800s, that was her time. And she was a proper Victorian lady. And she knew exactly what a girl should do and exactly what a boy should do. And as you can imagine, those two things were generally very different. Now, one of my favorite things to do was to jump over the fence around our yard. And I knew that my grandmother did not approve. So on my way home from school, I would look around to make sure that no one was watching. And if I saw no one, I would gather up my skirts and I would jump over that fence. But inevitably, grandmother would appear on the porch. Amelia Mary, how many times have I told you, dear, girls go through gates, only boys jump fences? And I would say, yes, ma'am, because of course I did respect her. But inside, I was thinking, I'm the only one who can jump this fence. None of the boys around here can jump this fence. One Christmas, Father gave Pidge and my younger sister, her real name is Muriel, but we've always called her Pidge. Father gave Pidge and me a sled, a proper sled with metal runners. Now, grandmother's idea of how a girl should ride a sled was that she should sit on it with her back very straight, her legs straight out in front of her, her skirt tucked around her legs, a blanket over her skirt, and someone should pull her on a level surface. Doesn't sound like much fun, does it? Pidge and I, we liked to go fast, and the faster the better. So we went out to the kitchen, and we got an old candle, and we rubbed that candle wax onto those metal runners until they were good and slick. And then we carried that sled to the top of the highest hill in Atchison. And I'm guessing that some of you have been to Atchison, have you not? Are you familiar with that? Second Avenue. And that is steep hill, isn't it? Yes. And I got to go first because I am older. And I put that sled under my arm and I started running with it. And I ran and I ran and I ran until I couldn't run any faster. And then I threw that sled on the ground and I threw myself on top of that sled. And zing! I went down that hill. Zing and zing and zing, block after block. And the wind was blowing through my hair. And I was flying. I really was flying. Because it had snowed about this much the day before. And you know how it melts at midday and then freezes again overnight. So there's a crust of ice on top of that snow. And I hit that ice and I flew through the air. And I was thinking how much Pidge was going to enjoy this when it was her turn. And then I saw at the bottom of the hill going to be very soon, where I was going to be very soon, was a wagon pulled by a horse, and I couldn't stop. I let out a yell. But the driver, he had his hat pulled down over his ears, and the horse had blinders on and wasn't paying attention to a thing. So I did the only thing I thought I could do. I steered that sled as best I could, and I went zing, right between the legs of that horse. When I finally came to a stop, and those of you who are familiar with Atchison know that I was also dealing with railroad tracks at the bottom of that hill, But when I finally came to a stop, I looked back up the hill at my sister, and Pidge was up there waving at me. So I stood up and I went, ta-da! Just as though I had planned the whole thing for her enjoyment. And I was so lucky because neither the horse nor the driver ever knew I was there, and that meant that my grandmother did not find out either. So I like to say that was my first flight. There's a family story that I saw my first aeroplane at the Iowa State Fair, but to tell you the truth, it was on the ground, and I don't remember it. I hate to admit it, but the truth is I was lobbying my parents for permission to purchase a kind of peach basket made into a hat. And I wasn't interested. Well, you know, the airplanes, they were on the ground. And they looked much like chicken crates, boards tied together with wire. And the peach basket was much more appealing than the chicken crate. I didn't become interested in flying until during the war. And by that time, of course, I was in college. I was in school near Philadelphia. And Pidge, though, she had gone to college in Toronto, Ontario. So my school let out for Christmas break earlier than hers, and I went up to Toronto to visit her and see this city that I was not familiar with. And we took a walk every morning, or tried to. And very early on, as we were on one of our walks, you know how you're just walking and talking and not thinking a whole lot about what you're seeing because you're talking to each other. But Pidge and I, we saw coming toward us a rather awkward-looking group of people. And as they got closer, I saw that it was four men. And then that they were all in uniform. And finally, that each of those men had only one leg. They were walking on crutches. That's why they were moving so strangely. And I watched as they walked toward us, and I watched as they walked past us, and I watched as they walked away. I will admit, I was rude. I stared. But something was changing inside me. I knew, of course, that there was a war on. I had been knitting hats and scarves and socks and sending them overseas with the Red Cross. All of my women friends had been doing that. We had been rolling bandages and sending those to Europe. But the United States had not been in the war as long as Canada had. And we had not seen wounded soldiers on the streets. I thought I understood about war. One of the pleasures of growing up in my grandparents' home is that Pidge and I, we were allowed to read anything in his library that we wanted to read. And he was a judge. He had one room that was just full of books. And a lot of those books were about war. But they were all about glory and honor and valor. And when bombs burst, they burst in air. They didn't cut through people. And I know it sounds stupid now, but when my friends went off to fight, I was jealous. I wanted to go. I knew that they were going to see new worlds. They were going to get to prove themselves. I was so jealous. I did not think about them coming back without a leg or an arm or worse. I didn't. And suddenly, everything else in my life was trivial. I could not go back to the Ogontz School for Girls, where they were trying to make us into proper wives for wealthy husbands. I had to do something to help those men. So for the rest of the war, I volunteered as an aide in a military hospital. We worked 12-hour shifts. But in the middle of the afternoon, we had a rather lengthy break. And my favorite thing to do during that break was to listen to the soldiers tell their stories. And the pilots had the best stories of all. Well, for one thing, they used the English language in a way I had never heard it used before. Yes, some of that also. But I was thinking about words like dead stick landing, pancake as a verb. We pancaked? I just peppered those men with questions. And finally, one of them offered to take us to an airfield. He was going to be released soon. And I still remember that Sunday afternoon. It was snowing lightly, but there was a little red plane up there flying loops and spins. And when the pilot saw that there were women down below, well, he proceeded to buzz us. Everyone else jumped back. But I just stood there. That plane, it spoke to me when it flew past. It was so close that the propeller drove the snow against my face, and it was just invigorating. I wanted to be in that plane. I wanted to be that pilot. I wanted it so badly. But this was during a war, and fuel was much too dear to be wasted on civilians. I had to wait until after the war. And, after the war, my father, who had always lived in the Midwest, my father decided that it might be a wise thing to start life over again in Southern California. And do you know, a good many of the pilots who made it back from the war, they were in Southern California also, and there were air shows every weekend, barnstormers, lessons taught. It was an exciting place to be for someone who wanted to learn to fly. I asked my father to find out how much it would cost to learn to fly. $1,000, which we did not have. But Father did have $5, which he loaned me so that I could go up for my first flight. And it was even more wonderful than I had imagined. You know, when it's just you and the plane in all of that sky, and you're flying between bits of cloud and maybe right into an early moon, and everything down below, everything tall flattens out and it all gets soft. Even the problems I had on the ground disappeared once I was up in the air because there was nothing I could do about them up there. That evening, I told my family, I said, I think I'd like to learn to fly, knowing I would die if I didn't get to. Now, Father was skeptical because of the money, but I got my first wage-paying job and a second job. For a while, three jobs, and for a short time, four jobs. I also had to find a woman to teach me because I wanted to be taken seriously, and I was not sure the men would do that. I had to get the right clothing so that I would fit in. I already had riding pants, I had field boots, but I had to buy a long leather jacket and, of course, a helmet and goggles. and start cutting my hair an inch at a time, my very long hair, an inch at a time so that Mother would not notice. And the first time I walked out onto that field, I tucked my hair under my jacket. I thought I could get away with having them think it was a man, just nobody would notice. And instead I was hearing, "Hey fellas, we've got a dude pilot! And there's a dude pilot on the field, everyone!" And I looked at them, and I had studied this. I really had. I had prepared. It's exactly what I did not want to have happen, had happened, and I wanted to know why. The new jacket, the shiny new jacket. Every one of their jackets. Well, you know, in those days, we were all our own mechanics. And we're out there, we're changing oil, we're wiping our hands on our jackets. A little skiff of wind comes up and blows a little dust, and it, yes. My jacket was shiny and new. I had several weeks before I could afford a second lesson. In that time, every night, I wore that jacket to bed, put some decent creases on it, and the day of my second lesson, I rubbed dirty oil into my jacket. And after that, all they said was that I was a natural. And that was fine with me. I had such a good time. I eventually purchased an airplane there. Bert Kinner, it was his field, and he was working with the first air-cooled engines for planes. I liked his Airster because it was small enough that I could wheel it out by myself. I didn't need to wait for someone to help me. It was a little biplane, yellow. I called it my Kinner Canary. Only three cylinders in the engine, though, and with the radial engine, if you lose one of three, you lose all three. So the other pilots did not like it, but I didn't have any trouble I couldn't get myself out of. After a few years, though, family problems. I sold my plane and bought a yellow Kissel car. Mother and Pidge and I traveled across the United States to Massachusetts, leaving Father in California. And I bounced around a bit. My idea had been to become a physician. But my experience in Toronto convinced me that I probably did not have the patience to be a physician, so maybe I would be a medical researcher. And I went back to college, actually enrolled in two schools for a while, neither knew I was at the other. But then this most wonderful thing happened. Now, I had thought up until this particular time in my life, I had thought that I would never hold one job for very long. Any job would be too boring. And it was Sam Chapman. He asked me to marry him, but he wanted a stay-at-home wife, and I didn't think I could do that. Even that would be too boring after a time. But I was working in a settlement house, helping people who were new to this country get settled in Boston. And they were coming from Italy and Ireland and China and Syria. And I was put in charge of young people's activities. And this day that changed my life, I was working with a group of children on a play. Now, I don't know what your experience has been with plays, but mine had always been that by 3 or 4 days before the play, we would be in final rehearsals. Well, with this group of children, those who had learned their lines had forgotten them. Those who had not learned their lines, of course, still did not know them. And the scenery remained to be seen. So I had a talk with the children. I said, "We can do something else. You know, we don't have to do a play. you know, we can have races, we can do board games. There's any manner of things that we can do instead. And they, oh, no, 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 because they had told their families, they told their friends, everybody was coming to the play, they really wanted to do the play. So I said, all right, but we have to work hard. And they were working hard. They were working a little chaotic, but they were working very hard. When one of my coworkers came in the door and told me that I had a phone call. Now, I told her I was much too busy to take that call, but she came right back and said that it was a Captain Rayleigh, and that Captain Rayleigh said he had to speak to me right away. So I took that call, I told the children keep working, took the call, and I was so glad I did, because Captain Rayleigh asked me if I would like to be the first woman to fly across the Atlantic Ocean. Can you imagine? I said, of course, of course. Now, he reminded me that quite a few people had died trying to fly across the Atlantic. And he said that I would have to be interviewed because they were looking for the right woman to represent all American women. Now, that first thing did not worry me, because we all have to, well, we're all going to pop off sometime, and I still cannot think of a better way to do it. But the interview had me worried. I mean, I wasn't even convinced that one woman could represent all American women, but I wanted to do it, you know? I hadn't been able to fly hardly at all. I couldn't afford it. And to be able to fly for almost 24 hours all at once? All right, how am I going to convince them? How am I going to convince this committee that I'm the one that they want? And as I was thinking about what I was going to wear and what I was going to say, grandmother's voice. Now, grandmother had been gone for a few years, but grandmother's voice came right in. And grandmother was telling me that it was very simple. She said, all you have to do is wear your prettiest party dress and be very sweet and very demure, and they will love you. Now, the only problem with them loving me is if they love me too much, and I knew the committee was going to be all men. If they love me too much, they might not want me to go because they might be loath to drown me. Then I thought about my Aunt Margaret. Now, Aunt Margaret was the one who saw that Pidge and I got our very first trousers, our first pants. And I was remembering when that package arrived at grandmother's, and oh, we knew it was coming. There it was, addressed to us from Aunt Margaret. We tore through the brown paper, opened the box, threw the tissue paper. There were those blue bloomers! And we ran upstairs, and we changed out of our dresses, and of course we'd worn dresses every day of our lives. We put on those gymnasium outfits, and we felt so free! And we ran down the stairs and outside, and we walked on our stilts, and we swung on our swings, and I jumped over the fence. And it was a wonderful feeling. And then, as we usually did, we started looking around for the other children, because we wanted to share that feeling with them. Well, we saw faces in the windows, but the faces, they were not coming out. And later, grandmother told us that the neighbors were asking if Mrs. Otis was not able to control her granddaughters running around like little boys they were, and what a scandal it was to see girls in bifurcated garments. So we knew that if we wanted our friends to play with us, we had to wear dresses. Grandmother Aunt Margaret. I mean, I knew if I was too much the 20th century woman, well, then they might not let me go either, because they might not think me proper enough to represent all American women. I decided that I would walk down the middle, be as ordinary as I possibly could be, wear a simple frock, be polite, answer their questions, not talk too much unless they ask me a question. And it worked. It worked. I was captain of this fine, big, trimotor airplane. But I found out very soon, and I've been telling people ever since, that even though I was captain, and even though I got to make a lot of decisions before we took off, once we were in the air, I didn't fly the plane. They had already hired a pilot and a co-pilot, both of them men. And I sat in the back. I even sat on a wooden box because, you know, we have to take out the seats to make room for the extra fuel tanks. I kept thinking that one of the boys would come back and say that they needed me to take over for a time. I was keeping the logbook. I was under contract to write a book, so I was looking out at the what the clouds looked like and taking notes about those. But I was really nothing more than a sack of potatoes on that flight, to tell you the truth. At one point, the cabin door flew open, and I had to reach out over the cold, gray Atlantic Ocean and pull the door shut and hold it until Slim came back and wired it for me. So I did make one contribution. There was another thing that happened. We'd been flying for about 20 hours, thought we should be seeing land. We were encouraged because we saw more and more boats beneath us, but we were flying like this, and most of those boats were on a perpendicular course to ours, so we thought, well, maybe we've gotten turned around, maybe our instruments aren't working, and we wanted to communicate with the captain of one of the ships, but we didn't have a radio that would do that. And as I said, I was sitting there in a wooden box without a lot to do, and my eyes lit on a sack of oranges that someone had given us. And I'd never thought about an orange being like a radio. But you use what you have, you know, and what we had were oranges. So I got a piece of paper, and I wrote a note. Ship's captain, please display your coordinates on deck. And I wrapped that note, you know, we wanted them to write their latitude and longitude in really large numbers on the deck of the ship, and then we would fly over and read them, and we would know where we were. And I wrapped that note around one of the oranges, and I secured it with a piece of string, and then I opened that cabin door again, just a little bit, and when I saw a boat, I dropped the orange, but I missed. We did, however, have more oranges and more paper. So I wrote another note. Ship's captain, please display your coordinates on deck. I wrapped that second note around another orange, tied it with another piece of string, and I promised myself that this time, as soon as I saw the bow of one of those ships, I would drop the orange. There! Yes, yes, yes! Missed again. Ship's captain, please display. And about that time, Slim came back and told me that they had seen land and I could stop pelting boats with oranges. I'm telling you this because you can imagine then my surprise when we arrived in Wales. And we had pontoons. We sat down on the water. We had to get somebody to come over with a boat and take us to shore, climbed up some wooden steps. But by that time, there was a crowd of people gathered. I didn't know any of them, but somehow they all knew me, and they were cheering me. Amelia! Amelia Earhart! Someone snatched the scarf from around my neck. I'm not famous. I am a social worker from Boston, and I didn't fly the plane. I was just a passenger, and I kept telling them that, and I kept saying, the boys, they're the ones who flew the plane. But no one was cheering. Wilmer Stoltz, Slim Gordon, it was all Amelia. And Amelia was really embarrassed. And finally I got tired and I listened. And what they were telling me was that they thought that by being a passenger on a very risky flight, I had done as much as a woman could do. Now, Charles Lindbergh had flown that same ocean the year before by himself. And I knew that a plane does not care who you are so long as you can fly it. I knew I could do it, but any time I talked that way, it was all, oh, no, 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 too risky, too risky. And what can you do when everyone's proud? Now, what I did was I went to the parties, I rode in the parades, I wrote my book, and I promised myself that one day I would fly across that ocean by myself. 4 years later, I was ready. 1932, I had my plane, a beautiful Lockheed Vega, red plane, gold stripes, single engine though. And I will never again fly a single engine plane over such a large body of water. But it was the best engine I could have, a Pratt & Whitney supercharged Wasp engine, 500 horsepower. That plane was ready, I was ready. Now, I was going to be flying across the North Atlantic again, so I knew I was probably going to run into some bad weather, but I'd been checking with the ships at sea, and I had a sense of what was what, I thought, and I wasn't greatly surprised when a few hours out, I encountered a bank of clouds that was so wide that I couldn't fly around the clouds. And all the way down to the ocean, so I couldn't fly under the clouds. I knew I was going to have to fly through, but that's all right. That's what I'd spent those 4 years on, instrument flying. I was ready. I checked my instruments one more time before I flew into that cloud, and I saw that my altimeter had died. Now, on a clear day, it wouldn't make any difference, right? I mean, you can look out and you can see the ocean and know that you are above the ocean. But I was going to be in the middle of a cloud where all I could see would be just gray, just beads of moisture. And I might think I was flying like this, when instead I might be flying like this and not know it. And if I hit the ocean, that would be it. I could not turn around and go back because I had too much fuel. It would be dangerous to land. So I decided that if it was the ocean that was worrying me, what I needed to do was to fly up. And that's what I did. I just started flying up and up and up and up and up. Have any of you ever flown on a cloudy day? And And you know how when you get up above the clouds, it's a totally different sort of day, and the sun is shining, and the sky is blue, and that's what I was trying to get to. Up and up and up and up, and suddenly the plane, it shook and stopped and started going down, down and down and down, and I realized what had happened. I'd gotten up so high in that cloud that the moisture from the cloud was freezing on the plane. That plane was encased in ice, and the ice, of course, was heavy. And my first reaction was, I've got to get it to go back up again. I wanted to be in that blue sky again. And then I realized that that wouldn't do any good. My only hope was to get to a low enough altitude that the temperature would be warmer and the ice would melt. But that meant going down. And I didn't know how high I was above that ocean without that altimeter, but I didn't have any choice. I had to go down, down and down and down and down and down and down. Longest flight of my life, down and down and down. I felt the ice break, and I pulled the plane up, and just as I did that, we broke through the cloud, and there were the ice caps, ocean, ice caps, right under the cloud. I still couldn't fly under the cloud. I had to go back up again, up and up, and this time I watched, and as soon as I saw those beads of moisture start to pull together and form ice, I took the plane down again, and again, the ice melted just as I broke out of the cloud, and still it was too close to the ocean, up and down and up and down. And I began to worry. I mean, in general, I say the time to worry is 4 months in advance. And I knew I had enough fuel to go from Newfoundland to Paris like this. But this is a much longer route and takes more fuel, and I wasn't sure how long I could do that. So you can imagine my relief when finally, the clouds thinned out, and I was able to keep an eye on that ocean and know that I was above the ocean. It was turbulent. It was a little turbulent, but I felt that the worst was behind me until I flew into a cloud, just a little wisp of a cloud. But that cloud was a bright orangey pink, and I knew that that color had to come from my plane. And I had thought I had felt shaking, but you know, this was happening too. And I raised up in my seat and I looked under the cowling over the engine, and sure enough, there were flames coming out. My engine was not on fire, but I could tell that shaking had caused a weld over a seam of the exhaust manifold to break. So instead of the exhaust going through and out, it was coming out up there. And of course, internal combustion engines, I mean, they're all about fire, and what I knew was that if I flew long enough, eventually the engine would come apart. And I had to think about turning around and going back. But when I thought about going back, I thought about all of those people who said it couldn't be done, that a woman could not fly a plane across the ocean and should not try. And then there were those people who thought that I'd already flown a plane across the ocean. I would have to be explaining that I did not fly the Fokker. I was just, yeah. And I had the best engine, strongest metal. I decided to keep on flying, and that's what I did. I flew and I flew and I flew, and the shaking got worse and worse. But finally, the sky started to get light in the east. And that meant that I should be seeing land soon. I switched over to my last tank, my reserve tank of fuel, and just when I thought that everything that could go wrong had gone wrong, I had a leak in the fuel gauge overhead. I had fuel dripping down on me. Now, I wasn't going to lose a lot of fuel that way, but I've always had a rather queasy stomach, and I thought, what if I get sick and lose control of the plane? And then as the fumes started to escape the cockpit, I thought, what if those fumes and those flames should meet, and so I flew very close to the ocean just in case, looking for land and looking for land, and finally, I saw land. And I had already told myself I wouldn't worry about finding Paris. I would land at the first airstrip I found, but all I found were rocks. Rocks, more rocks. I found a railroad track then. I followed the railroad track, and about that time, I realized I had done it. I had successfully flown across the ocean. And no one could take that away from me, but I wanted to live to celebrate it, you know? So I finally found a little bit of a cow pasture. It wasn't very level, but it was relatively smooth. And I landed there, and then I went in search of someone, a farmhand, who told me that I was in Gallagher's Field, and that turned out to be in Ireland. So that's why the rocks. And I will tell you, though, my sister was not there. The crowds of people. Maybe you went to the went to the movie house and you saw the newsreel, and you saw the crowds of people around my plane. And the announcer was saying, "Here's Amelia Earhart, having just landed near Londonderry, Ireland." Actually, they were filming it the day after I landed because they were in Paris. I just stayed right there. So when I landed, it was just cows, but I have never felt more like saying, ta-da! And I feel that I have one more record-setting flight left in me, and that's this trip around the world at its waistband. I have a lot of plans for after that, but I have been going on, and I promised I would take your questions. So, does someone have a question of me? Over here, yes.
To World War II, was there ties between the president and you? Were there missions that you made that, you know, the president requested? There was some stuff, you know, in history wrote about that, much like the pitcher Mo Berg. You know, he traveled around the world and in essence was a spy for the U.S. Was there any missions documented that you were watching things for President Roosevelt?
I prefer to try to do this. I'm going to take off my jacket when I'm the historian. So my name is really Ann Burney, and I'm up here, very pleased to be up here from Kansas. And then we can bring Amelia back. I'll put the jacket back on. But this was kind of skating. I didn't want to play with you as Amelia. There's some really interesting possibilities about what happened to Earhart. She disappeared. We know she made it about three-quarters of the way around the globe. She had a navigator with her, Fred Noonan. They made it from Australia, New Guinea. And to our knowledge, no one has seen her since New Guinea. They had to get to Howland Island, which is just a mile and a half by a half mile long. They had to get there to refuel. There was a Coast Guard cutter there, and they had a radio so that they didn't have to drop oranges. There was a radio, radio direction finder. But it wasn't working very well for her. So the Coast Guard people were sending out signals to help her find the island. She was sending back signals, and they were hearing her, but she kept saying she wasn't hearing them. So Earhart, she said she was running low on fuel. They said, "We must be on you, but we cannot see you." And then there's nothing. "Oh, we're running on a north-south line." And nothing. So what happened? One of the theories is that when she first wrecked the plane at Hawaii, she took the plane back to California, back to the Lockheed plant. The Roosevelts were her friends. She had campaigned for FDR for his second term of office. She and Eleanor had, you know, really enjoyed each other's company. If there are people who have said Earhart wouldn't, she was a pacifist. She was anti-war. She would never have spied, never have been a spy. And, you know, 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, spy was a really bad word. And, you know, she just would never have done that. I think that if her president had asked her to take some pictures over the Marshall Islands and so that they could know what armaments the Japanese had, if he had asked her to do that to help, this was 37, that it might help keep us out of war, would she have said no? Especially if he'd said, look, I know you're already a debt up to here for this flight, and you're gonna add to that? You know, we'll give you a brand new plane. Don't even worry about repairing that one. We will give you another Electra model that'll fly a little further, a little faster. You just make a little detour before you go to Howland. You fly over the Marshalls. We've got to cut a hole in the fuselage. You can drop a camera in. You can take the pictures. Give the camera and the film to our representative who's going to be on that Coast Guard cutter when you land at Howland. And, so there are lots of fascinating stories. I got an email sometime back. Hello, Amelia Earhart. As you may know, some people think you've been here before. Would you like to come back again? And it was from the Northern Mariana Islands Humanities Council. So I got to go to Saipan and Tinian and Rota and do performances. And at the very end, after I'd done 9 performances in 5 days or something, I got to do a little touring and stand in the jail that supposedly Amelia Earhart was held in after the Japanese captured Amelia and Fred was killed, and or maybe they were both killed, or maybe, you know, those were two other Caucasians, or maybe nobody was there. And Roosevelt's kind of in the middle of a lot of that thinking. Did that answer your question? Yeah, and then some. Sorry. Okay.
If we could give Miss Earhart a round of applause. Dr. Burney, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ann Burney, an independent scholar of American Studies, and a member of Ride Into History, an historical performance troupe that has toured throughout the United States. Dr. Burney's presentation was titled Amelia Earhart, First Lady of the Air. It was given in the persona of the famous early 20th century pioneer and aviatrix. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 14th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.